Hi, and welcome to How Curious, KGOU's signature program that brings you stories about lesser-known aspects of Oklahoma's past and present events, people, and places. I'm How Curious host Rachel Hopkin, and today's episode is focused on an Oklahoma place within OKC's Bricktown. I'm walking up to it now. Can you guess where I'm going by the sounds we're hearing? Just in case not, once I get inside, I quickly run into a character who seemed very at home here.
I've been playing banjo since I was a tadpole, but I have never seen anything like this. They have got the world's largest collection of banjos on display. Welcome to the American Banjo Museum! Yay!
Thank you, Kermit. I'm so excited to be here. I really am. I love the banjo. And so as soon as I learned that this place existed, I had to come and check it out. Johnny Beyer is the museum's executive director, and he's been involved right from its early days in Guthrie, Oklahoma, in the late 90s.
There was an industrialist named Jack Conine who had a company called the Banjo Corporation, and banjo collecting became his hobby. When he got to his retirement, he wanted to divest his banjo collection and started looking all over the country to find a recipient who would take his collection. Unfortunately, none of the major museums wanted it, so he decided to get behind the effort to start a banjo museum all by itself in Guthrie, Oklahoma.
He called it the National Four-String Banjo Hall of Fame Museum, and it was specifically dedicated to the style of instrument and playing that was popular during the 1920s jazz age.
The idea was a completely niche museum. It was very, very specialized, and it was aimed at banjo players. We were hoping that banjo players were going to make a pilgrimage to Guthrie, Oklahoma to see that collection. And the reality was we sat there most days and there would be nobody who came through the door. At some point in time, Mr. Conine realized that we needed to open our spectrum of collecting and presenting to all styles of banjo, including before, during, and since the jazz age. And with that move, we changed our name to the American Banjo Museum.
The decision was also taken that the museum needed a new home.
We did a nationwide search for a new site. We went to Nashville, we went to Memphis, we went to cities with musical identities, and then it hit us. We didn't want to go to one of those cities. Otherwise, we may be associated with, in New Orleans, simply jazz music. Nashville, simply country music, that sort of thing. So staying in Oklahoma City, as we had already established a presence in Oklahoma, seemed to be the right thing to do.
Lucas Ross, who's in charge of the museum's education initiatives, showed me around its main floor, much of which is still given over to that original collection of four-string jazz age banjos.
As somebody who doesn't play the banjo or any instrument, whenever I come into a musical instrument museum, I feel like I should be seeing something more than I am. So
Okay. What
do you see here? Ooh. As we come into this massive display of banjos?
Yes, right when we come around and get to see some of these early instruments before the banjo became manufactured.
Lucas is drawing my attention to how much banjos and banjo production changed in a fairly short time frame. The earliest instruments on display here date from the mid-1800s and look handmade and fairly basic. They also have open backs, which means the sound that they make is muted. But towards the second half of the 19th century, instrument makers were responding to greater demands from would-be banjoists.
To improve the sound, they added resonators on the back. That's the hardwood backing with little vent holes around the front so the sound could escape. Kind of an acoustic version of a speaker that they could point the sound out forward. Well, it gave an opportunity to decorate the back. And so some of this inlay and some of this carving is incredible. They really became true works of art, not just for the sounds and the music they could create, but the visuals.
I've put photos of some of these jaw-droppingly gorgeous instruments created in the 1920s and 30s on our webpage. Search for KGOU and How Curious. Now, at the time these instruments were being made in Jazz Age America, the banjo was all the rage, similar in popularity to the electric guitar today, and it attracted a certain type of player. Here's Johnny Beyer again.
The banjo players during the Jazz Age were primarily men, primarily white, and they were primarily playing rhythm. They were setting this Charleston-esque tempo, da, 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 for the people to dance the Charleston and that popular dances of the day. So it was, at that point, much of a big city thing, and it was mainstream as well. There was a band leader named Paul Whiteman, they called the King of Jazz, and his banjoist Michael Pingator was as popular as any rock star today.
A burst of Michael Pingator wowing crowds with the Paul Whiteman Orchestra in the mid-1920s. Now, text on the American Banjo Museum's website states that just as the banjo has evolved for nearly 400 years in the United States to take on many forms and styles, the American Banjo Museum has expanded and made a commitment to present every chapter of the banjo's story, and it's not always an easy story to tell. It's not just that the banjo can pop up all over the place, in European classical music, ragtime, blues, jazz, Celtic, or genres associated with the rural South, such as old time and bluegrass, etc. But also, it's because of the charged nature of much of that history. As musician, historian, and 2025 Banjo Hall of Fame inductee Don Flemons notes in his new introductory video for the museum,
"No musical instrument carries with it as much racial baggage as the banjo."
The early history of the banjo began centuries before it became a jazz age phenomenon.
The defining features of a banjo are its drum-like body, which virtually every culture had drums. At some point in time, a handle was attached to a drum body. This would have been in a number of cultures. As it turns out, enslaved Africans brought knowledge of such an instrument to the United States through the Caribbean slave trade in the mid-1600s. A drum body with a handle attached to it and strings stretching from the drum body to that end of that handle. There's very, very little written history about those early days. We can say with certainty that for 200 years on American soil, it was enslaved Africans playing the banjo and developing the banjo that it was exclusive to black culture.
The opening section of the museum aims to highlight this early history by drawing on imagery created by an artist who achieved unusual success in the late 1800s in a painting called The Banjo Lesson.
Henry Ossawa Tanner was really a rare thing and very special for a black painter to be elevated at that time. And one of his most famous paintings, because it depicted African Americans in a non-stereotypical way, has been acclaimed and celebrated. We love it because it is one of the closest connections we have to those early banjo players. We don't know the men and women that played that instrument and that built that instrument from memories of African-inspired instruments. This is a way for us to pay tribute to the unsung heroes, the kind of the unknown soldier of the banjo. It depicts what would be maybe a grandfather teaching his grandson to play the banjo.
Unfortunately, even as Tanner was working on the banjo lesson, his depiction was in stark contrast to most representations of African Americans in the public sphere at that time, which alas came courtesy of a truly egregious cultural form.
The transition from the banjo being exclusive to black culture to it becoming a white show business instrument primarily happened during the period we call minstrelsy. This was an unthinkable by today's standards trend, but what it entailed was white performers performing in blackface, doing the most grossly exaggerated and negative stereotypical performances, and they used it with the banjo. The banjo was central to minstrelsy, and they did circuses, medicine shows, and music hall performances, all in that manner. Minstrelsy was an accepted form of entertainment. As I say, it would be unthinkable now, and I want to make sure that anyone understands by talking about minstrelsy, we are not promoting it or condoning it, but we have to say it was part of the banjo story.
Visually, it's shocking and appalling to see what the minstrel show represented.
Here's Don Flemons again.
In another fashion, one of the things that it did do is that it created interest in black musical forms, where before black people were completely invisible from the legitimate stage. And the banjo, as it became more popular, one of the things that happened is several of the performers created method books that allowed people to begin to learn the instrument. And not just in minstrel shows, this just became a part of general American music.
Even so, that dark practice had long-lasting repercussions.
When minstrelsy started to take hold as American white show business, there was a general pushback among the black culture away from the instrument which their ancestors introduced to the American soil. It was a scar that ran very, very deep. Now, that's not to be misunderstood or misconstrued that African Americans were not making great strides in music, primarily on other instruments, the piano and the guitar, early blues, early ragtime, evolving into jazz. These were all things that black culture had immensely incalculable contributions to. But unfortunately, many of them were overlooked because they were not in white show business.
Away from show business, the banjo remained important in the music of the rural American South, regardless of any color divides. But while white musical figures such as the politically activist Pete Seeger or the bluegrass supremo Earl Scruggs became iconic, black banjo players mostly remained less visible, at least until recent decades.
By 2005, you had the first major academic event on the African and Caribbean roots of the banjo, the Black Banjo Gathering, which happened in Appalachian State University. That was sort of the first moment when you had a concentrated effort to reclaim an active African-American community of banjo players.
Don Flemons was at that gathering and went on to form the Carolina Chocolate Drops.
As a black string band, we were able to advocate for the black banjo story in a way that allowed for people to be able to see it in a modern and a living context, and especially because we were playing traditional music as well. And so now a lot of the younger people now are able to view the instrument not necessarily as something that is the exclusive property of one community or another.
And as Flemons' former bandmate Rhiannon Giddens strummed her stuff for one of the lead tracks on Beyoncé's most recent and Grammy Award-winning studio album, the banjo once again was part of the American mainstream. This ain't Texas.
Ain't no hold'em. People can see that it is a very multifaceted instrument, and even though there's a lot of hard history, it is still an instrument that is built on a diverse community and a diverse culture, and it has many stories to tell.
And just because many of the banjos are behind glass at the American Banjo Museum, it doesn't mean they have to stay silent, according to its executive director, Johnny Beyer.
The banjos are in glass cases to protect them, but any person that wants to play any style of banjo, any make of banjo, any era of banjo, all they have to do is ask, and we'll be happy to accommodate their request. We're trying to do a service for the banjo community here.
Many thanks to Johnny Beyer and Lucas Ross of the American Banjo Museum and Hall of Fame, and to one of its newest inductees, Don Flemons. How Curious is a KGOU public radio production. The managing editor is Logan Layden. David Gray composed our theme music, and I'm Rachel Hopkin. You know that if you have an Oklahoma-related question or idea for a future episode, we'd love to hear about it. Just drop us a line at curious@kgou.org.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.